listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 33rd installment in our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR. Luciana, pleasure to have you with us again.
Thank you, Dan. Pleasure to be here.
So now we go to this critical period, the 30s, the pre-war period, before the German invasion of the USSR. We have Trotsky still sniping at the Soviet government, even up to Operation Barbarossa, pretty much. And Stalin laying out an analysis of what's going on in the world, what Trotsky represents with respect to the things going on in the world, and what the USSR has to do. So let's dive into some of that.
Yeah, I thought we would talk about fascism, imperialism, and war in the 1930s. And let's see, and to ask, so what was Trotsky's view, what was Trotsky's view, and what was Stalin's view about how to deal with the situation, the leading to war, which looked like, you know, it was going to happen.
Right.
Now, I had a little introduction, and so just to remind people, listeners, what exactly was the alignment of forces in the 1930s in Europe. So in the 1930s, most European countries, with the exception of the Soviet Union, had either fascist governments, from Spain to Italy to Austria to Poland,
right,
or fascist political forces ready to go over as soon as the Germans either invaded or were near invasion, places such as Romania,
right,
and Hungary.
Right.
Now, of the big powers, only France and England maintain a political system of what we call classic liberal democracy, by which, of course, I mean parliamentarian systems in partnership with capitalism.
And then places like France, of course, you had, you know, waiting in the immediate wings, people like Pétain, who, you know, was essentially a fascist. They had some power already and were kind of gathering forces on the ground. And the UK as well, by the way. Chamberlain is not exactly, Churchill, rather, is not exactly someone that you would say represented liberal democracy, even though he's glued on as a face of it in public discourse in the post-war period. He was a hard-nosed imperialist, and I would say, you know, semi-fascist, too.
So really, so the map of Europe before the invasion was pretty much fascist or pro-fascist.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
That's right.
So these two liberal, so-called liberal democracy, were, of course, as you pointed out, imperialist. Pointed out for England, they had an empire and they had subject colonies.
Right, and France.
So you
too.
Had three apparently different systems:
right.
Fascism, imperialist, liberal democracy, right. and socialism.
Right.
So should Hitler begin a war, how should the other two systems react, especially the Soviet Union and the communist parties throughout Europe? So Trotsky had one view and Stalin had another. So to be a Trotskyist in the 1930s was to have this position, neither with the European democracies nor with the Soviet Union. What he recommended was world revolution. Permanent revolution led by the world proletariat. Later on, we will elucidate this term, finally. So why should we, Trotskyists, not side with the democracies? Because they were imperialist, and they were a bigger enemy of the proletariat revolution than fascism. Now, that is true, of course.
Right.
In the long run, imperialism was the biggest obstacle to the development of socialism, and, you know, that was just common knowledge among theoretical communists, Marxist-Leninists. Yes, it was true. Imperialism was the bigger threat to potential social revolutions, to social revolution. But fascism was the immediate threat. Trotsky proposed that this threat provided the opportunity for revolutionary uprising to defeat imperialism. The same things he had said in Spain.
Right.
It was disastrous.
Right.
Revolution within a fascist attack. So, that was one. Two, so why shouldn't we Trotskyists side with the Soviet Union? Because, Trotsky says, in essence, Stalinism was fascism.
Right. This is the big ideological kernel of this, by the way.
Yes. Yes, we will. We have a lot to talk about that. Now, the Soviet bureaucracy, he claimed, has adopted the political methods of fascism. Political methods of fascism mean imprisonment, torture. We can see him referring to what the Western myth is, that the purges of the 1930s, 35, 36, the trials and all that, were not, in fact, an action against treasonous activities, and was, in fact, a civil war, a new civil war, a political civil war within the Soviet Union. I'm interpreting here.
Understood.
The Soviet Union was a police state. It's what we identify with fascism, a police state. So, but what he's referring to is his own interpretation in his own interest, that what was really tried in Moscow and what was punished was treason, was a plot to overthrow the government of the Soviet Union.
Right.
And we haven't talked about that.
That's right. There's another aspect to it, too, which, you know.
Yeah?
We saw this kind of, political confusion deliberately floated during the 80s, during the Reagan administration, which was, a distinction even. First, a lumping of totalitarian, quote-unquote, governments and authoritarian, quote-unquote, governments, where they allege the same behavior to both camps, but
yes.
Based on, in reality, based on the economic relations, because it's interesting, the imperialists are more Marxist in their analysis of the world than many people that walk around calling themselves Marxists, in that, to them, the distinctive feature here was economic power. If the bourgeoisie had control of the organs of the state, and the state was acting in defense of or in prosecution of the rights of the bourgeoisie to the economic life of a society, then the tactics or the methods that are used, brutal or not, are fine. And if it's not the bourgeoisie, but rather the proletariat or others, the poor, in essence, on whose behalf the government is acting, that's totalitarian and that is no-go. So their distinction is the economic relations, and that's how they decide what's good and what's not. And so you start with this, going back in the 30s, this slander that, because first of all, the idea to a Marxist that the political tactics of something are what determines rather than economic relations, the nature of, even if you had the same behaviors by the government in both places, on whose behalf is the government acting? And in the Soviet Union, it's on behalf of a socialist economy that's being constructed by and for and of the workers. And it's an entirely different situation, for example, Krupp Steel and others, and, go across Europe.
Yeah, exactly. The dictatorship, that's why it's a dictatorship. It's called the dictatorship of the proletariat,
right,
as opposed to the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. In the
right.
dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, the economic power determines the political features of the state. Why do they call it a dictatorship of the proletariat?
Well, it's because it's prosecuting the interests of the class as a primary function, regardless of the niceties.
It's a neutral term, really.
Exactly, that's right.
It's kind of classical Roman,
Right, that's right.
A dictator
exactly
was
right.
allowed in Rome.
Right. Step in and organize us to fix this problem and then step out. That's basically what a dictator was in Rome.
That's right. That's right. So, and in both cases, the economic power dictated the structure of the state, the political.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know if the word is correct to say dictated, but was a reflection,
a government,
as you said.
A government,
right?
Or an administration or whatever. I mean, you can use those words also. In other words, an operation of the commanding levers of society of this class or that class.
Mm, yeah, that's right. It was really Trotsky that propagandized, that introduced in the term totalitarian, which then Hannah Arendt picked up in her book Totalitarianism, and which is argued to be, I think, very reasonably by philosophers to be a nonsense term, but that too we haven't quite gone into yet. So Trotsky's claim was that the Trotskyists, communists, real communists, should not side with the Soviet Union because it had this fascist feature. It was a totalitarian dictatorship, a totalitarian regime. And he said, the Soviet Union is at once a fascist country and a partner of imperialism.
Mm.
Might as well call the USSR a fascist imperialist lackey of the Western democracy, and he does.
Yep.
And the fault is all with the Soviet bureaucracy, which is his name for the ruling, for the government of the Soviet Union. It's his name for the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Did you want to say something?
No, no. Go ahead. I'm following just fine.
Okay. He said this Soviet bureaucracy, the Communist Party, they are a caste, an oligarchy. They are the cause of the degeneration of the first worker state. That's the worker, degeneration of the worker state. That's for the benefit of the left, the future left, that we'll call it. No, we can't be communist in the Soviet manner, because that was the degeneration of the first worker state. They are a new exploitative class. The present regime in the USSR is a special system of class exploitation. So, the third reason, he says, that the Soviet Union, that we should avoid, that we shouldn't be with the Soviet Union, Trotskyists, because Stalin would side with Britain to curry favor among the European democracy. And continuing his quote, Stalin says to Washington, London, and Paris, recognize me, Stalin, as an equal partner. So he's craving recognition. Stalin is craving recognition from the imperialists.
According to Trotsky, keep that in mind, folks.
Yeah. According to Trotsky, Stalin says to Washington, London, and Paris, he says, quote, recognize me. Stalin never said that. This is him.
Right. That's right.
Trotsky imagining Stalin speaking, speaking for Stalin. Recognize me as an equal partner, and I will help you put down the revolutionary movement in the colonies and semi-colonies, for this I have in my service hundreds of agents. Stalinism has become the leprosy of the liberating movement. Now, let's just pause a minute. He says, I will help you put down the revolutionary movement. He is talking about the man who penned a very important Marxist book called On Nationalities in 1913. Lenin set him to write a landmark, a book on nationalities, because Lenin realized that there would be, if the revolution happened, there was the problem of the people in beyond the Urals and in the Caucasus who were colonies within the Tsarist Empire.
Right.
So it was decided, of course, that if the revolution happened, the first decree would be peace, and the second decree would be equality, and including the right to secede, to all the what we now call minorities, and they very nicely called nationalities, of the former empire. He's talking about the man and the party that almost immediately in 1923 went to help the colonial insurrection in China.
Right.
Right. This depicting this party as opposed to colonial insurrections when that is,
European history and I would have to say that Trotsky's perspective also betrays this prejudice. It ignores what happened in Asia. It's bewildering. It's inscrutable. All these stupid words that they've used, but you could have people Even, you know, your average, I'm saying not average, but, you know, maybe a lot of people, college students, et cetera, describe in general, if in accurate terms, the evolution of political thought in Western Europe and also of the societies there, even yeah. some of them with some Marxist terminology, if not concepts. But if you ask them to discuss those things about Asia, for example, you know, the parallels between what happened in Russia, Soviet Union, and China, the parallels between the wars, attacks by fascism against each of them, you know, the history that was going on and developing in each place. They don't know a damn thing about Asia. And so Stalin going to, you know, going to China, for example, at this point in time, and every place in between, you know, you see the fruits of that in the 1940s, and you have to remember while he was doing that, Mao Zedong was walking or marching, so to speak, all over China, and even Chiang Kai-shek was, in essence, I mean, compared to people in the United States, he was a communist practically. I mean, he was certainly a nationalist, and at that time it was something.
He was a nationalist. He eventually sold out.
Yes, yeah. And he
that's
did.
The Taiwan.
Yes, he ended up being. Yes. He ended up being, you know, the guy who, you know, set up the whole, all of China on a city block. But in essence, you know, though that war was going on, he was an anti-fascist. Also, that's the point. You know, if you want to talk about whatever Churchill or any of these other characters in Europe were against the Germans. Chiang Kai-shek against the Japanese was, you know, a mountain of a man.
Well,
and then there's Mao.
To unite it, yes.
And then there's Mao. Well, Stalin, in this inconsequential trip where he won't learn anything about the provinces, is in the thick of it with Mao and Chiang Kai-shek, just as a part of his implementing the nationality strategy of the USSR that he would eventually run.
Exactly. Now, you've just pointed out a very important distinction in Marxism, let's call it communism, whatever you want to call it. Eastern Marxism versus Western Marxism. Did the unions or the Communist Party in France organize general strikes, all kinds of stoppages, disturbances, when the Algerian War broke out, the Algerian War for Independence in 1954, for example.
Right. Or the Vietnamese War for Independence in 1954.
And that's right. Where was the Western, even Communist parties, when the Third World struggles for independence started? Nowhere.
Right. Well, who were their who were their delegates to Ban Doon, for example? We don't know. Exactly.
That's right. There was not a single presence from the West, was there?
Right. That's right. I mean, not really. Not of note,
really,
for sure.
This is what killed. This is so important. Eastern Marxism had a concept of had a concept of imperialism,
right?
Had a concept of imperialism, and that was Lenin that did that. You know, that's why you're a Marxist Leninist.
Right.
That is anti-capitalist, but also anti-imperialist.
That's right.
Otherwise, in a period of imperialism, if you're not a Marxist Leninist, you're not a Marxist anymore.
Right. That's right. To me, that's the most relevant point to what's going on today, which we will get to ultimately in a few weeks.
Yes, that is a key point. And today, right, so you have anti-fascist organizations that go and fight the KKK, and they should, but they do not respond to the United States attack on Syria. A country that's emerging, that a country that has fought for independence from France and European powers, has has acquired independence and now is again under attack for colonization. So you go and fight South or wherever against fascism, but you don't fight imperialism, you're not a Marxist.
Right. That's right.
Plain as that, whatever you call yourself.
That's right.
So that's very important for us to discuss, for people to discuss, for us to discuss in future.
For sure.
So anyway, in fact, I have notes in my outline saying just what we said. Okay, Trotsky, so this was more or less the fourth reason we don't join the Soviet Union, because it's a police state. And the proof for that Trotsky brings forth is the monstrous purges, in his words, in the USSR are the most convincing testimony of the fact that the people are against the Soviet system and want to eject the bureaucracy. Now, what he was saying was, I can tell you it's a police state because they had these monstrous purges. And these monstrous purges occurred, he implies, because the Soviet people rose up against the Soviet state. When in fact it was his gang,
right,
the Trotskyists within the Soviet Union,
right,
that were sabotaging mines,
right,
and doing all sorts of disruption, including terrorism, killing Kirov, for example.
Yeah, that's right.
There was an attempt to subvert the state. And here, Turkey says, you see those purges where he condemned all those innocent people? That's proof that the Soviet people are not with the Soviet government. And so we shouldn't support the Soviet Union because the people don't.
Right.
Because the Soviet people themselves don't.
That's his argument. Yep.
You know?
Yep.
So the Stalin's purges are proof of the fact that the bureaucracy has become a ruling class and the people want to overthrow it. So let's go with the people rather than the bureaucracy. Well, fifth reason. Oh, no, this is just my note.
It's okay.
On my comment on the fact that it resonates today. That Stalinism and fascism are the same, which we mentioned, and they are both totalitarian. This is the whole of Western propaganda today. This declaration in the EU Parliament to condemn totalitarianism,
yep,
both fascism and communism, etc. Yeah, you were going to say.
No, that's right. There's just what's been in the media today, even a discussion among quote-unquote communists, quote-unquote anti-imperialists, yeah, et cetera. You know, Russia is that. There is no champion of the working class on the global stage. Russia is, there's some red characteristics, but it is brown, red and brown at best. People that are arguing that fight imperialism by working in conjunction with or defending Russia, they're, working in a red and brown coalition, whether they know it or not, because Russia is essentially fascist. Also, the administration of China and the, fact that there's a private sector that's a very substantial one there shows that its government also is red-brown at best and perhaps overtly fascist. So the only place that we can go with these people is world revolution. Well, y'all have been saying that since like 1905. When are you going to start it so we can join it?
Yes, but and of course, they concentrate what you were just saying. What they do with China? China is irrelevant, actually. Right. China is capitalist and imperialist. So this again, you see the indifference by whatever we call left.
How is China imperialist?
In the West, whatever it is that is left or Marxist or whatever they call them, they're not.
They're not, right?
They haven't studied Marxism,
right?
So again, we have this blindness. Something really terrific is happening in China.
That's right.
But nobody looks at it. And if they do, they call it capitalist and imperialist right. and dismiss it.
Yeah, especially
this
though, for me, the thing, here's the thing.
Between Western
yeah.
and Eastern Marxism.
The thing, I mean, to the point here, on the question of imperialism, they call it an imperialist country. A, it has no colonies. B, they say the imperialism rests on the fact that it's reaching out to the rest of the world to do business and trade and you know, economic relations, and to offer another route to development than that offered by imperialism. And that, of course, puts them on par with, you know, as just an alternate imperialist power with the existing
yeah.
imperialist structure, and therefore not worthy of consideration except for condemnation.
Except that they haven't read a word of Lenin. For them, they can't tell the difference between imperialism, an imperialist power, and a tin pot dictatorship.
That's
really.
Right, for sure. Right.
In other words, they don't know the features of the economic features that propel imperialism. For one, the overdevelopment of the nation, the full development of the nation, which then the nation doesn't yield any profits anymore.
Right.
So the capitalists have to go abroad.
Yep, they have to go
forage, exploit and extract resources.
And then, of course, the history of it shows
people.
That these things happened sort of in uneven rates, that they kind of happened together and sort of orbit each
yeah.
other through the development process. But we have nothing like that in China. And there's nothing like that in Russia either. Any parts of Russia that are imperial, quote unquote, that you know, those relations were settled like in the 15th century or earlier, and so that it's not really true. You've had one nation of people, more or less, with many nationalities, multi-plural national nation
yeah.
for
and
you know
so
a half a millennia, and China goes back millennia. Okay, we got to stop here because we're out of time. I guess we can go to Stalin's critique of this after we finish
yeah.
Finish up Trotsky's allegations next week. So thank you very much,
World
Luciana.
Revolution is where we're going to begin next week.
Great,
the
good place to start.
Theory of World Revolution by Trotsky and the critique of Stalin
okay.
by Stalin.
Very good. Okay, thank you. I'm looking forward to it. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening. Today we're going to take a look at the crisis that's been developing over allegations that Russia poisoned ex-spy and his daughter in the UK. We begin with this interview with Russia's ambassador to the UK, Alexander Yakovenko, conducted by RT's journalist Anastasia Shirkina.
Ambassador, thank you very much for joining us at this obviously extremely busy time for you. I'd like to get started with your reaction to the measures that Theresa May announced. Did you see them as too much given the situation? Were they proportionate? What did you think when you heard the list that she's announced of measures to be taken?
First of all, I want to say that everything what was announced by the British government and personally by Prime Minister Theresa May is unacceptable, unjustified. This really hurts the Russian-British relations. Of course, the measures are very strong because we're talking about the expulsion of the 23 Russian diplomats. This is 40% of the diplomatic staff of the embassy. And of course, it will definitely make the activity of the embassy quite difficult. But this is the new reality, so all these people have to leave by the 21st of March. They got only 1 week. But this is life, and the embassy will function as usual, but of course in a little bit reduced staff.
What did you make of comments? We heard UK Defense Secretary Gavin Williamson speaking, and he used quite unusual, I would say, language for diplomacy, where he talked about Russia needing to go away and, as he put it, shut up. Do you think this is conducive to the situation, or is this kind of how things will be from now on?
No, well, it's difficult to say, but I have some reservations about the political culture and the way how discussion is going on. And of course, the way how the Minister of Defense is putting his views, quite surprising for us. But this is the new reality, new political culture in the United Kingdom. But we hear this kind of statements, you know, all the time in the Parliament from the British officials. For the Russian ear, it's and for the ear of any diplomat in the world, it's a little bit shocking. But when you live here in London, you know, for a while, you know, you can get used to this.
When you first learned of this story, because this has only gone on for just over a week now, and it seems to have snowballed so much, and events unraveled so quickly, when you first heard of, you know, this story with a double agent and his daughter, did you expect this come to this kind of breaking point, that situation? When it was said that there's a connection to Russia, did you foresee that it would come to this kind of crescendo?
Once we got the information from the media about that accident with the poisoning of two Russian citizens, we immediately requested the Foreign Office to give us the details, what happened, you know, where the investigation stands, you know, what are the reports of the police. But almost, you know, less than 12 hours, we heard the statement of Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, who said that this is, who blamed Russia for everything what's happened in Salisbury. And for us, that's, you know, that's really, you know, surprised me because, you know, the investigation has just started and the member of the government is blaming the other states. It's quite a serious, let's say, blame without any evidence. And I was really surprised. Then I had a meeting with the Boris Johnson. I was summoned to the Foreign Office, and my country got the ultimatum. This is first, and the second, of course, we were blamed that everything would happen there. This is the responsibility of Russia. So the ultimatum was very simple, you know, 24 hours, and we have to answer basically to two questions. The first question is we have to confirm or deny that substance, and as Boris Johnson put it, this is the, under the British classification, this is A234. So basically this is based on their calculations, this is the name of that substance. Because we don't have any, access to this substance. That's why we have to trust the classification of the British. So Boris Johnson said we have to either confirm or deny that that's somehow we mismanaged this kind of substance, the stockpiles. And the second one, that was the question whether if the first answer will be the negative, the second question is we have to acknowledge that this is the Russian aggression, you know, this is the Russia who did it. Next day, we gave an official, we sent the official note, and there were two points there. The first one, of course, we're not ready to discuss all these things in a way of the ultimatum. And of course, you know, Russia is not the country which is ready to talk this way. This is first. Second, we pointed out to our British counterparts that in order, if they have any questions any information, they have to deal in accordance with the international law. Russia and UK are the members of the Organization for Prohibition of the Chemical Weapons. And there are, under Article 9, Paragraph 2, there are procedures. In case you have any suspicions, you have to apply to this organization officially and ask for the consultations with the specific countries with whom you have this kind of suspicions, and then you have to get the answer within the 10 days, or maybe earlier. And if you are not satisfied with the answer, then you have special procedures where the organization itself will be switched to this process. So instead of that, the British side decided just to talk to us, you know, in the way of the ultimatums. So this is the way how they are behaving.
But just to clarify for those who don't know, both Britain and Russia are part of that organization.
Yeah, that's right.
So this would be normal protocol under these circumstances,
yes,
that there's,
yes,
an official request filed,
yeah,
and 10
right.
days are given.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So this is the official procedure, and we all, like all the members of that organization, are subscribed on that. But since we are blamed that this, under the British classification, agent A234 is the Russian origin, we asked the British side officially by note to share the samples of that in order to make our own conclusions. And we were denied. So that gave us additional suspicions about the policy.
Was there a reason given as to why?
No, they said just no. We're not going to give you anything.
And Boris Johnson has said that they are going to send a sample to the OPCW, but not to Russia.
That was later. That was later. So basically, of course, we're welcome to, let's say, to send this to the organization. But still, I just spoke to our ambassador to this organization, and he said that so far the organization didn't get any formal request from the British side. It means that I don't know how they're going to act, but for the time being, no official procedure was launched. And this is another, let's say, very suspicious behavior of the British side. So all the investigation about the Skripal is classified. We don't have any information. We don't have any access. Nobody saw even the pictures of that people in the hospital, whether they're alive or maybe they are just in good health. So nobody talked to the doctors. You know, there is absolutely no transparency in this case, and this is worries us. But by the way, under the international law and the Vienna Convention, we have to get the access to these people because they are Russian citizens. And we're also being denied. So basically, Britain doesn't respect the international law, and the way how they're behaving, puts a lot of questions.
What did you make of some of the media coverage of this story? Because obviously anti-Russia moods, if you can put it that way, have been prevalent for quite some time. So when this story happened, were you surprised to see the way it unraveled, given the investigation is still going on and the police have not made any official statements in terms of pointing fingers quite yet?
The launch was made after the speech of Boris Johnson. That was the next day. So immediately under the command, you know, of the foreign secretary, we got all these media reports without any evidence. If you read the British newspapers, you will see that there are no evidence. This is first. At the beginning of this campaign, we heard two things quite interesting. The first one, there were calls that the license of the RT should be revoked. And the second one, that there were promises in the parliament to launch the cyber attack against Russia. So basically there was a strong reaction from the Russian side about the presence of the RT in the UK. But what is interesting, we officially requested the explanations about the plans of the Britain to launch this cyber attack. It's a real cyber attack against the country. It's the act of war. First of all, we didn't get the official answer to this note. And somehow, 2 days ago, that topic disappeared from the British newspapers and from any statements from in the parliament. So basically, I think that the British side decided that was too much. So two things, RT and the cyber attack disappeared from the British media. So this is the answer to your question.
What do you make of some of the terminology being used, including Theresa May, Boris Johnson? She's used the words highly likely. That got a lot of traction. He today said, when asked how certain he is that Russia's behind this on a scale from 1 to 10, he said 9.98. Yet he's also said there's overwhelming evidence that points at Russia. Do you think, given the gravity of the accusations and the consequences that are clearly already following in this story, there should just be more certainty provided?
I'll tell you, this is quite a trick, because when you don't have evidence, when you don't have any proofs, you have to use the word likely, probably, maybe. because the British side cannot provide any information. They cannot provide any access to the investigation. That's why, in order to say something for sure, you have to present the evidence, and they cannot do this.
But then why would they go so far with these kinds of measures that are being put in place?
I think this is the, if you look back to the policy of the UK, you will find that the Britain in new circumstances is trying to find its new place in the, let's say, even in the Western society, because they are leaving EU and everything what is left, you know, I'm not talking about the United Nations, but the key organization, this is NATO. And Britain is trying to find the place, and this place they found on so-called anti-Russian campaign and the way how they want to deter Russia. That's why we have seen a year ago the new concept of national security, where Russia was named as the major enemy to Britain. Then there was a banquet speech where we basically got the confirmation that we're the enemy. And there is one more reason for, let's say, diverting the attention of the British public is this is the Brexit. Because the situation is with the negotiations is not so easy in this country. And Britain is will definitely... has to find the solutions with the European Union, and for the time being, I don't see any results from the negotiations. And they have, in order to divert the attention from the Brexit, they have to let's say to present something to the public that could move a little bit to the other side. And that's a great possibility to launch this anti-Russian campaign, anti-Russian attack. And so this is the scenario which was written in London, but from my point of view, this is a very short-sighted scenario, because in the long run, Britain have to explain what is behind all these things in Salisbury. I think they have to explain what they're doing in this secret chemical laboratory, which is 8 miles from the Salisbury. Where they investigated that substance based on their, let's say, information on their samples, based on the certain standards they have. And this, I think this will be the question that they have to clarify in the Organization for Proliferation of the Chemical Weapons. Because everything what is being said today looks for us very suspicious.
Just to go back for a little bit to the relationship between Russia and the UK now, where does it go from here? Because we've seen in recent months, especially with some of the accusations flying around, people have been asking, is this kind of new Cold War? Today, Williamson was asked about this, and he said, he didn't use the term Cold War, but he said extremely, extremely chilly. Where does the relationship go from here? And where would Russia like it to go from here this week and then moving forward? And what would it take to for this kind of gridlock to move somewhere?
Well, if you look at the concept of the Russian foreign policy and everything what we did all these years, the major task for us is to create favorable conditions for the development of my country. So this is the way how we are putting all the relations with all the other countries. By the way, if you look at the world, you will find that maybe something like with the 120 countries, we don't have a visa regime. So we want to have the friendly relations. So that was the goal, of course, of our policy with the UK. And that was the job of any ambassador, including me. And so all these years, despite the difficulties that we have with Britain, we tried to find the opportunities for the political dialogue. And we created the right formats, you know, like the Minister of Defense format. You know, there was active participation in the political life during the Olympic Games here. So we tried to promote the economic relations and, you know, business is our ally here, because, you know, they simply don't understand what's happening, you know, with the government, but they have limited influence on them. So culture, science, you know, everybody's interested. Probably the political, let's say, so-called deep state. So they're putting the policy that we're witnessing. So basically, approach will be very simple. First of all, we want to clarify all the questions that are behind this kind of a provocation. This is exactly what we see. This is first. And then we'll see what are the other possibilities, because we have to influence Britain. Britain is the permanent member of the Security Council, and we're interested to hear our views, and we want to influence on the British policy. And in order to have this influence, you have to have the mechanisms. That's why our policy will be, quite balanced. We have strategic patience, but we will never allow to talk to us such a language as you just heard from the Minister of Defense. This is not our language. So we are right. We know what we're doing, as Theresa May said. And the time will come when the people of Britain will understand that they have maybe to have another government or another people who will have a better policy towards Russia in our bilateral relations. We are always open for any constructive cooperation because, as I said, our task is to create as favorable condition for my country, to development of this country. Because we're busy with our own economy. So we're not going to put anybody as the enemy or something. It's not our policy. But we have strategic patience. Britain is facing quite a serious steps on our side on two directions. The first one, of course, will demand to answer all our notes and official requests. So we're talking about the get the samples of that A234 under the British classification. This is the poison, as they put it. This is, we have to get the access to the to this family of Skripal. By the way, we ask the access and so consular access to the another gentleman who died here. He's a Russian citizen, Mr. Lushkov, and the circumstances are very suspicious. So we will get all the answers from the British side in the Organization for the Proliferation of the Chemical Weapons. We'll get access to the all investigations that they're doing. And, of course, I'm quite sure that we'll get all the results. It's not just a one-day story. It's not a media story. But at the end of the day, we'll clarify the whole situation with the policy of Britain. So that's why we are confident. That's why we know that we are right. We believe this is the right direction of work with the British, but it should be done in a legal way, not just through the media. And of course, I think that that we'll put the British to the table of not the negotiations, at least the conversation. Because for the time being, they're escaping of doing this.